Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the mass protests that have erupted in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia over the past weeks. Pro-Western Georgians say free speech and democracy are at risk. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and at 1400 hours GMT on Tuesday, 14th of May, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State is in Kyiv, where he's told President Zelensky the new American weapons package will bolster Ukrainian forces. Georgia's parliament has adopted a controversial new law that's prompted mass protests. And a Thai activist detained for insulting the monarchy has died in prison after going on hunger strike. Also in this podcast...
It seems like I'm looking at a picture of a wooden surface.
Oh, you know what? That was the thing I sent you before. Don't worry, I'm not actually a table. Okay, so take another look.
A new and more interactive version of ChatGPT is launched. He's there to provide a strong sense of reassurance, a US official said. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in Ukraine, a surprise visit, and his first stop was the presidential palace in Kyiv to meet Volodymyr Zelensky. Mr. Blinken described this as a difficult moment for Ukraine, and that would certainly be hard to disagree with. Russian troops are continuing to advance in the country's northeast, where fighting is fierce. But Mr. Blinken insisted that new arms deliveries from the US would make a crucial difference.
The assistance is now on the way. Some of it's already arrived. More of it will be arriving. And that's going to make a real difference against the ongoing Russian aggression on the battlefield. And we're determined, along with many other partners for Ukraine, to make sure that you succeed on the battlefield.
The warm words are no doubt welcome. But what can the US Secretary of State actually achieve by visiting Ukraine at this point? Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is travelling with Mr. Blinken. I was with him when he met the Ukrainian president. Mr. Zelensky, he said, didn't seek to downplay the present crisis.
It was notable, I thought, how much President Zelensky referenced the fact that this was, in his words, a challenging time, a tough period. He talked about four warriors in the east of the country. But he thanked Mr. Blinken for what he called the bipartisan support with the military assistance package that was passed by Congress last month. That has been desperately needed by the Ukrainians. Mr. Blinken also referenced the fact that it was a challenging moment, but he said the two countries had been on a long journey together. And since then, they've been in these talks. And I think this will be a key moment in Mr. Blinken's visit here after what was a very early arrival by train this morning. We arrived by sleeper all the way from the Polish border here into Kyiv.
Those crucial weapons that the United States has now said it's going to be sending, or other military aid to sending to Ukraine, do we know exactly how much has arrived and how much of those really necessary weapons are there that the Ukrainians say are desperately needed at the moment?
We don't know the quantities, but what a senior US official has said in the run-up to the trip here is that some of these weapons have started to arrive on the front line. And that comes within, you know, just a three-week period when that $61 billion assistance package was passed by Congress. So what, some of the things we know that they needed the most that they are now getting from that package are artillery shells, crucially, but also long-range precision-guided missiles. Now, these are something that the White House made clear within the last few months that they had started to deliver to the Ukrainians. And they're now likely to get a lot more, I think, because of that military assistance package. The other thing we heard from Volodymyr Zelensky is their crucial need for more air defences. And he described this as Ukraine's greatest deficit. He talks about, for example, the need for another two US Patriot missile defence systems in Kharkiv, you know, in the area that you've been talking about that's undergone this surprise Russian assault in the last 4 days. So they still critically need those weapons. That US official saying that they are among those armaments that have been delivered since the military aid package was passed 3 weeks ago.
Tom Bateman. As we record this podcast, news has come in that Georgia's parliament has approved a bill on foreign agents, which has provoked a political crisis in the country. There have been scuffles in the parliament and protests outside it. The new law would force civil society groups and media organisations to declare foreign funding. Opponents fear it will be used to silence dissent. I asked our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, whether there were any more hurdles or this meant the bill would definitely now pass into law.
Well, it is in terms of that was the third reading, but it goes now to the president, Georgia's president, Salome Zurabishvili, and she has promised to veto it. She's very much in favour of Georgia joining the EU. She thinks it will get in the way of that process. And then it has to go back to Parliament. And the governing Georgian Dream Party has enough support in Parliament to override her veto. So I think from here on in, it's effectively going to pass. But the protest will continue for sure. There is a large amount of people outside. They've been chanting, they've been waving EU flags, US flags. So those protests will continue. There's a huge security presence in the city, riot police, water cannons stationed in the centre of Tbilisi. And it's possible that those could turn violent later.
We've talked about the controversy over this law within the country and the bitter battles. But of course, it's had a lot of criticism internationally, this bill. What's going to be the effect of it being passed?
Well, we've already had the EU speaking yet again on this. A spokesperson has said that it would be a serious obstacle for Georgia in its European perspective. Georgia, as you remember, at the end of last year, was given candidate status for membership. So that was seen as a big success on the Georgian front, but it threatens that. The Kremlin, however, says that the Western powers, not just the EU, the US as well, it says they're meddling in domestic Georgian politics. Now, the Georgian...
Something Russia would never do, of course.
This has obviously moved in on Abkhazia and South Ossetia and taken control of parts of Georgia. So we wait to see basically the next steps on this, whether there is any particular kind of violence or whether confrontation between the president and the Georgian Dream Party.
Danny Eberhardt. Today is Israel's National Day, marking its declaration of independence on 14th of May 1948. As part of the celebrations each year, the annual Israel Prize is awarded, the country's highest honour. But this year, the choice of winner has caused something of a stir. Eyal Waldman made a fortune from tech, and he's given much of it away. But he's also an arch critic of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who he accuses of deliberately undermining Israeli democracy. Waldman also lost his own daughter during the attacks by Hamas on October the 7th and blames the Prime Minister for his role in allowing the tragedy to happen. The BBC's Wira Davis reports.
Across Israel yesterday, sirens rang out to mark Memorial Day, a solemn day of national unity when a country, so often at the front line, honours its war dead. But at some events, unity turned to anger. Families of hostages still being held in Gaza shouted at right-wing ministers who they say have abandoned their loved ones in pursuit of a drawn-out military campaign. After 7 months of war, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is hemorrhaging support.
I believe Netanyahu has to go. I think every day he's still the Prime Minister. It's the wrong thing. It's bad for Israel.
Eyal Waldman lost his 24-year-old daughter, Danielle, killed by Hamas gunmen at the Nova Music Festival. The billionaire, tech entrepreneur and philanthropist agrees that Hamas must be defeated, but says the Prime Minister of 15 years, increasingly reliant on religious and right-wing nationalist support, should accept responsibility for what happened on October the 7th and a war that is losing focus.
It's not only me, you know, if the US president has said it's very hard for them to work with this current government. In Germany, in the UK, are saying it's hard for us to work with Netanyahu and with the current government. If you're the head of the state, if the prime minister, you can shake off your responsibility of what happened. Netanyahu supported make Hamas stronger, and I think it's the right time for him to understand and call for elections and obviously take responsibility for what happened on October 7th.
Even before the war, Waldman was a thorn in the side of Netanyahu's government, campaigning against controversial proposals to weaken the Supreme Court. When he was nominated by an independent committee for this year's prestigious Israel Prize, it was widely reported that Netanyahu's allies tried to block him, calling for this year's awards to be cancelled because of the war. Israel is increasingly divided. On the same day that anti-government protesters made their feelings clear, right-wing youths were ransacking aid trucks taking supplies into Gaza. Hanoch Milvitsky is a member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, for Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. He says there's no truth in the notion that the prime minister would crudely interfere with awarding a prize to a political opponent, and says there is still broad support for the government's war aims.
I don't think that there's a growing movement opposing the war. I think there's a growing movement in the Israeli media trying to oppose the war because the Israeli media are very critical of the government and want to see a different government in Israel. I don't think the state of Israel can allow itself to stop the war when the people that committed October 7th are still in power in Gaza. That cannot happen.
But at home and abroad, the protests grow. When this war eventually ends, there will be an inquiry, and most observers believe elections sooner rather than later. Ayel Waldman, who says he's proud of his Israel Prize, is still contemplating his future as a grieving father who still believes in coexistence and the possibility of a region free from conflict.
Wira Davis. One of Thailand's best-known political activists, Nettiporn Senesankom, has died in prison after being on hunger strike for 110 days. She was in prison facing charges of defaming the monarchy, an offence punishable by up to 15 years in jail. Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head, told me from Bangkok first how Nettipon came to prominence.
She's part of a generation of younger Thais who, during the military government that came in under a coup in 2014, really had a change, complete change of view about their country and started, and they were the first generation to do it, to question this sort of sacred role of the monarchy, its enormous power and wealth. And there was a tremendous wave of protests in 2020, a very unusual year because of COVID, but because of a number of other reasons. We had about 5 or 6 months of them here in Bangkok where unprecedented demands were made. She was one of the most hardline and most demanding of all of the activists. And when those protests died down, she kept up her activism, kept on sort of various attempts to try and get people to question the monarchy. That's why she was charged. There are around 270 people who've been charged under this absolutely ferocious Les Majesty law since 2020. She was denied bail, and her hunger strike when she was jailed in January over this bail denial was very much a protest against that and against the whole wider judicial system in Thailand, which makes any kind of critical comment about the monarchy a criminal offence. She had declined in health, but according to the prison authorities, they say she'd actually started eating and drinking again last month, and then suddenly this morning she suffered a cardiac arrest, and so they were unable to revive her. There will be a post-mortem tomorrow morning, and the government is handling this quite carefully. It knows that there'll be a lot of anger about this. It's inviting her family to come in and see the whole process of the post-mortem to try and understand why she died so suddenly. She was only 28 years old.
Jonathan, when the current king came to the throne, I remember there was some speculation that they might loosen those terribly strict laws you mentioned about insulting the monarchy, but listening to you, it doesn't sound like that's very likely to happen at all.
Well, it did happen. The new king, although he was a far less popular figure than his father had been, seemed to understand that the Les Majesty law often made the monarchy look bad, and initially that was what he did. He didn't use the law for about 2 years. But these protests that started 4 years ago were so unprecedented and such a shock to the monarchy. They were so outspoken in their demands for reform. They started implementing the law again on an extent that they've never done before. It's been very widely used. And so in a sense, any comment about the monarchy has been completely stifled. I mean, remember, the party that won the general election in Thailand last year was banned from forming a government, was blocked from forming a government, because it said, and it wasn't asking for the Les Majesty law to be abolished, just to soften the punishments. And we saw one man jailed for 50 years earlier this year for his comments on the monarchy online. So you can see why so many young people feel it's still an issue that has to be addressed, even though the laws are making that extremely difficult.
Jonathan Head. Now to India, where a general election's underway and Prime Minister Narendra Modi's campaign pledges on the economy have raised concerns they could put a strain on precious resources like water. The fast-growing city of Bengaluru is one that could be affected. It's only just seen its very first rains of the year. From there, the BBC's James Kumarasamy reports.
We're heading out to the eastern edges of this rapidly expanding city in what appears to be an almost permanent rush hour. All around are signs of construction and huge glass-fronted buildings which belong to tech companies attracted to this Silicon Valley of the East. But this rapid expansion, as well as bringing opportunities, has also brought huge challenges. And Bengaluru is suffering from a major water shortage.
Hi, I'm Zibby, and I'm a community volunteer.
Zibby is part of a residence group in Whitefield, a Bengaluru suburb that's prospered and modernised with the IT boom. But unlike central Bengaluru, which pumps in water from the state's main Kaveri River, around 100 kilometres away, these residents rely largely on groundwater for their supplies.
There is a crisis happening in Bangalore in the outer areas which are not serviced by Kaveri. The population has increased to this point that we are having this crisis.
We don't have any sufficient of water.
Shashay Kumar is one of those filling the gaps. His six multicoloured vehicles make up one of the many private fleets of water trucks that rumble through the city's parched streets. They're usually filled from the four wells that he's drilled in a dusty parking lot. But as one of his drivers fills a 6,000-litre truck, he tells us that two of his wells have run dry, so he's had to hike prices, and that's led to accusations that he is part of a water mafia. We set off on a delivery journey with a cab's eye view of the city. On the roads in front of us, dozens of water trucks and tractors pulling water containers. The fact they're all needed speaks to a wider problem, says Sunita Narain, director of the Centre for Science and Environment in Delhi.
So Bengaluru is a classic case. It's a case of every Indian city. And I would argue with you, it's a case of every city in the world, which has had the arrogance of thinking that it can bring water from longer and longer distances. Now, this is where Bengaluru, like Cape Town, like Delhi, and like, I would argue, even London, needs to rethink, seriously rethink, water in times of climate change.
Sunita Narain, ending that report by James Kumarasamy. Still to come in this podcast.
You don't really know how you're going to react until you're in that situation. But how do you fight off a crocodile? It was terrifying.
How a British woman saved her twin sister, quite literally, from the jaws of death.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the mass protests that have erupted in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia over the past weeks. Pro-Western Georgians say free speech and democracy are at risk. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
In Mozambique, the smuggling of illegally harvested wood from the country's forests to China is estimated to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year. A report from the Environmental Investigation Agency, which campaigns against environmental crime and abuse, says that the trade is out of control and fueling one of the world's least reported conflicts. Alex Bloom is the lead author, and she spoke to the BBC's Rob Young.
For many years, we've been looking at the timber sector in Cabo Delgado, Mozambique, and we've seen massive volumes of illegal timber being exported from the country, unprocessed in log form, most of that going to China. And unfortunately, that is in violation of Mozambique's log export ban. In addition to that, we found that in the province of Cabo Delgado, there's a nexus between this illicit timber sector and the trade, and the insurgency that has been occupying the north of the country. Since 2017, over 500,000 tons of unprocessed wood has been imported by China from Mozambique annually.
And how much of that is against Mozambique's law?
Unfortunately, all of that is unprocessed and is in violation of Mozambique's log export ban. And so the entirety of it is in breach of the national log export ban that's been in place since 2017.
Is it possible the authorities don't know about it?
This has been reported on for years, and it's quite likely the authorities are well aware of it. The former environmental minister, Correa, has talked about it quite a lot and has imposed over the years different measures to try to contain the scale of the trade. So that is why in 2017, what had previously been a log export ban on just a subclass of species was expanded to all native species. And there have been crackdowns over the year to try to limit the scale of the damage. But unfortunately, there's been just very unabated volumes continuing in spite of that ban. And that's enabled by the conflict and by corruption.
Right. So it's happening in an area beyond the reach of the central government?
It is a country with high levels of poverty. And in addition, Cabo Delgado is the northernmost province, so it's quite far from the capital. It doesn't benefit from as many resources. And there's a lot of corruption there. So while some officials try to do the right thing, there's a lot of other officials who are benefiting as well from some of the corruption involved.
And you said it's linked to the violence in Cabo Delgado. Just explain how that is.
Yeah, so in our investigation, we had over 30 sources interviewed who are involved in some way in the timber sector in Cabo Delgado or knowledgeable about that sector. And what they described is that the timber traders buy wood from different forests, different origins around the province of Cabo Delgado, including illegal sources and from insurgency occupied areas, even areas where insurgents have cut down wood themselves and are benefiting from the sales and from the profits of that timber sector. All that wood is then brought to Montepuez, where most of these traders have their sawmill and containerizing processes. And the wood is all mixed together, put in containers, and then trucked to Mozambique's ports to be shipped and exported, most of that to China. So China needs to do more to uphold its commitments to illegal deforestation and to its partnership with Mozambique.
Alex Bloom talking to Rob Young. There's hardly any area of our life now that's not influenced by artificial intelligence and the technologies being updated ever more rapidly. Now, a new version of ChatGPT has been launched. The 4.0 update apparently recognizes different languages, reads your emotions, and you can talk to it rather than just communicating by text, as they demonstrated at the launch on Monday night.
Hey, ChatGPT.
Hey there. What's up? How can I brighten your day today?
Okay, yeah, so I'm going to show you a selfie of what I look like, and then I'd like you to try to see what emotions I'm feeling based on how I'm looking.
Sounds like a fun challenge. Go ahead and show me that selfie, and I'll put my emotional detective hat on.
Okay, so here's me. So what kind of emotions do you think I'm feeling?
It seems like I'm looking at a picture of a wooden surface.
Oh, you know what? That was the thing I sent you before. Don't worry, I'm not actually a table. Okay, so take another look.
That makes more sense. There we go. It looks like you're feeling pretty happy and cheerful.
Well, our tech editor Zoe Kleinman was enjoying all that fun at the launch and explained why this latest ChatGPT version represents a technical step forward.
The big thing about it is, I think, number one, it can recognize text, speech and images. And number two, it speaks and there's no latency. That means there's no delay between you asking it something or showing it something and it responding. It's got this kind of warm, expressive voice sounding like a sort of young American woman. It's chatty and, as you said, a little bit flirty as well. And I think what it shows us that's really interesting is where this tech is going. You know, we're very much looking at a massive rival to assistance like Siri and Alexa. Sorry if I've just set yours off at home there. But you can see it becoming a conversational companion. And it is a big leap forward, I think, for this kind of technology that we've heard so much about and seen so much investment pouring into for so long. I think increasingly people are going to struggle to believe that these things aren't sentient because they are convincing. At one point, the demonstrator said to this device, you know, you're awesome. And it replied, oh, stop it. You're making me blush. And it was very quick about very natural conversation. It is important to say it's not sentient. It is a machine. It's a complicated bit of programming. It's very sophisticated, but it is not thinking for itself. I think increasingly, though, that is the idea. You know, Elon Musk has said if these things are successful, they can become like a human companion and help to ease loneliness. And I think what we saw last night was that perhaps this is possible.
Zoe Kleinman, artificial intelligence is one of those areas which seems to generate hopes and fears in equal measure. Fears among the general public, but also among those who work in the AI field, like Wendy Hall, a professor of computer science and director of the Web Science Institute.
My worry is that it's more likely to be able to fool people into thinking it's a human being. So what are the safeguards they're building in? What are the guidelines they're giving us for using it? And how have they tested it? That's what they're not telling us.
What scenarios are you worried about how it would be used or could be used to fool people?
Imagine, you know, the scams where it sounds like your daughter or son are ringing you up to ask for money. That sort of impersonation, the fake news that we're talking about with elections, it'll be easier to do and it'll be easier to fool people because it'll be more human-like. So we can use it for all sorts of good things, but it will also be applied for the bad things. And that's what we're not getting from the companies, are the guidelines as to how best to use this new technology and how safe is it? How have they tested it?
Wendy Hall speaking to Michelle Hussein. Good news for the fight to prevent heart attacks and strokes. It turns out that a medicine designed to tackle obesity is also effective against those other health issues. Semaglutide is what it's called technically, but it's sold under the brand names Wegovy or Ozempic. And what's got researchers so excited is that it seems to reduce heart trouble and strokes whether or not the people injected with it actually lose weight. The study was conducted by the cardiologist Professor John Deanfield, who explained the long history behind the drug's development.
This class of drugs, they're called GLP-1 receptor agonists or GLP-1 RAs, were originally introduced as treatments for diabetes, but were shown subsequently to produce a significant amount of weight loss. So this trial that we did recruited more than 17,000 people and gave them the drug, Govi, or semaglutide, over more than 4 years. And these were people who had previous heart disease, but who were living with overweight or obesity, but did not have diabetes. And what it showed was that there was about a 20% reduction in their cardiovascular events subsequently, in association with about a 10% loss in their weight. There was a second point that was equally interesting, is when we looked at the amount of weight they lost in the trial, that was unrelated to the cardiovascular benefit that they got. There is a wide-scale opportunity, but of course these drugs have to be evaluated in the usual way. Certainly, if you don't take these drugs and you continue with your previous lifestyle, eating habits and the like, a substantial number of people put weight back on. But that's not really very different from what we have with other drugs like statins for lowering cholesterol or indeed blood pressure lowering medications. If you have high blood pressure, you need to take your medicines for life to reduce that blood pressure to get the benefit. And it may be the same with these drugs.
John Deanfield. Now, I've had a chance to look at a couple of websites today which offer advice on what to do if you're attacked by a crocodile. In case you're wondering, the perhaps rather obvious suggestion is that you should run away. That, however, was not the reaction of Georgia Laurie. The 31-year-old from southern England was on holiday in Mexico with her twin sister Melissa 3 years ago when a crocodile tried to drag Melissa underwater. Instead of fleeing, Georgia punched the crocodile repeatedly in the face, saving her sister's life. And today she received the King's Gallantry Medal. The sisters told their story to the BBC's Laura Maxwell.
Honestly, it feels like it was yesterday. It's gone so quickly. But the whole experience was just terrifying. You know, if you don't really know how you're going to react until you're in that situation. But, you know, how do you fight off a crocodile? It was terrifying, you know. The first thing we saw was it swim towards us. And so we tried to get away as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, Melissa was snatched underwater. And I couldn't hear any response from her when I was calling out for her name. And so that's when I decided to go back and find her, and I saw her body floating towards me in the mangroves.
Oh, gosh.
And unfortunately, the crocodile came back at that point and it grabbed her by the ankle and it dragged her away from me. So I was punching it off her and trying to keep her head up above water at the same time. And thankfully, it swam away again and I managed to drag her away a little bit somewhere more secluded. But it came back a third time, unfortunately. So, yeah, the fight carried on another time, and eventually I got her onto the boat. And yeah, it was a long and arduous ordeal.
Do you know how long it lasted for? It must have felt like it went on forever.
It did. It felt like it went on forever, but perhaps it was only 5 minutes. But, you know, time kind of stands still in that situation. And everything around you kind of switches off. It was like my senses were heightened, but everything was in focus in front of me. It was just me and my fight with the crocodile.
Melissa, do you remember anything about this?
I only remember the first attack where the crocodile bit my hand and dragged me underwater. And I don't remember much until sort of waking up. I think before the second attack, I started flailing my arms about. I must have been in a fit or something. And then it took me away. And then the third time, it actually death rolled me. And thankfully, I don't remember that happening at all. Until waking up onto the boat, you know, I was very delirious.
I'm just struggling to know how both of you must feel looking back on this, because it does sound like such a horrific thing. Have you recovered, Georgia, as well? Because despite the fact that it was Melissa that went through it, you watched it and were such a huge part of it.
You know, I feel like these things definitely do make you stronger emotionally, certainly in the sense it enables you to connect with people. And I think that's a really lovely thing. But it does, you know, it's certainly something that is a journey that... It just takes time.
Georgia Laurie and her very lucky sister, Melissa, speaking to Laura Maxwell. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sydney Dundin and the producer was Richard Hamilton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the mass protests that have erupted in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia over the past weeks. Pro-Western Georgians say free speech and democracy are at risk. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.